Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Leah Binder, CEO of the Leapfrog Group, dedicated to improving patient safety in America's hospitals. They just released the latest report on the number of preventable deaths in American hospitals, 161,000 last year alone, which is actually an improvement from the 250,000 just a few years ago. She'll talk about the hospital safety grade scorecard and look at what leads to hospitals having poor scores and outcomes. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Leah Binder of the Leapfrog Group on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Leah Binder, President and CEO of Leapfrog Group, an independent nonprofit organization dedicated to improving safety and quality in American hospital care. Ms. Binder also launched the Hospital Safety Grade, which just released its latest report on hospital safety across the country, including the number of patient deaths due to medical errors. She has repeatedly been named to Modern Healthcare's 100 Most Influential People in Healthcare. She earned her bachelor's degree from Brandeis University and two master's degrees from the University of Pennsylvania in Communication and Government. Leah, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's 4 years now since we talked with you. And we discussed the prevalence of deaths in American hospitals due to preventable causes. And it's really a staggering amount, a quarter of a million deaths per year. And Leapfrog has joined forces again with Johns Hopkins Institute for Patient Safety. And you just released some new numbers. And certainly there's been an improvement. It's estimated 160,000 deaths. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners the most revealing data from your report and why this problem still persists.
Right. There's good news and there's bad news. The good news is that we have fewer avoidable deaths in hospitals. So we have 161,000 attributed to measures in our hospital safety grade. So it's not actually all errors and accidents that can happen in hospitals, but it's the ones we can measure. And it's fewer than when we measured it 3 years ago. I mean, that's specifically 45,000 people who are alive today who might have died last year from something that was avoidable. So that's good news. Great news, actually, is that for many years, so many people have been really trying hard to improve the problem of patient safety. What we never, ever see are results. So seeing this is positive and powerful. But, of course, the bad news is 160,000 people. I mean, that is a big number. That is 500 people a day. That's a really terrible problem, and it's completely solvable. These are just accidents and errors. These are not things that cost a lot of money to solve either. I mean, a hospital, you just need to follow rules. Everybody works there has to wash their hands. Everybody has to be vigilant and careful about the patient 24/7. It's not easy to do that, but it is not expensive and it's not impossible.
Well, Leah, as you say, 160,000 deaths is far too many. We know the known causes, the surgical errors, the medical mistakes, medication errors. But your research reveals that a poor or a failing hospital score is a pretty good indicator that a patient is more likely to experience a medical error or a deadly mishap. So talk with us about how these hospital scores are compiled, and really, how do they act as a important guidepost for consumers seeking the best possible outcomes in their care? And also, are they a truly highly motivating factor in getting organizations and their staffs to change their behavior?
Yes, they are motivational. We have seen absolutely incredible efforts by hospitals to get that A. And so I want to give credit to the hospital community where that is happening. We are seeing enormous resources. By resources, I mean will and courage and leadership brought to the table to really improve performance of hospitals and get that A. We know, for all having been kids, at one point, most of us have had to get a letter grade.
Yep.
You know how motivational it can be
when you
get that A, B, C, D, or F. And it really is motivational. It gives you something to aspire to, mm-hmm. and it also reminds you when you have work to do. So the way we come up with the grades is kind of like they did when you were in school. We have 28 different measures of safety. So we're looking at errors and infection rates, never events rates, so things like leaving a sponge in after surgery. Unfortunately, some of those terrible things do happen, and they are actually published. We know when they happen. And we also look at how they prevent those events. What do they have in place, the right systems that are known to keep patients safe? For example, do they use an electronic system for prescribing drugs? That is the most common error made in hospitals, is problems with medications. Imagine how easy it is to give someone a much higher dose than they should get, or give them something that they're allergic to. And electronic prescribing systems can prevent 40% or more of those from happening. So do they have that? So we're looking at those things. And we combine them all and we score them. We have a dream team of experts in patient safety nationally who help us to develop the methodology. And so when we asked Johns Hopkins to look at, well, what's the death rate and what's the problem in A versus B versus C versus D and F hospitals, we want to know, are we actually showing that there's a difference? Because if there's no difference between an A or B or C, we don't have the right method. But in fact, we do. And the method we used from 3 years ago showed that there was major difference in the death rate between the different letter grades. And this year, the difference is even more compelling than we found originally. So your chances of an avoidable death, getting killed in a DNF hospital, is 92% greater than if you go to an A hospital. So almost twice as likely to die of an error or an infection. And actually, you're 88% more likely to die in a C hospital than an A hospital. So even the C hospitals show significantly poorer performance than an A hospital. And B hospitals also were more likely to die, not as bad, 35%. So there's differences. The letter grade is relevant, and everybody should really pay attention to it and also pay attention to it every 6 months because hospitals change. I'm amazed and impressed by how much effort hospitals put into getting that A, and they show results.
Leah, I am still trying to get my head around the 500 per day. I mean, that's a staggering amount, and those are sort of in a binary relationship. You're alive or dead, but then you have lots of people who weren't dead, but were obviously caused enormous harm in the system. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the broader problem of patient harm and why that's so hard to track.
Well, the problem with patient safety is it tends to be invisible. To your point, it's hard to find these incidents. So typically, the way that we understand what's actually happening in healthcare and measure the quality is by billing data, which isn't exactly perfect. Mm-hmm. Billing data is meant to get hospitals paid, not to figure out how high quality service they're delivering. That's how your employers and health plans track what's actually happening in healthcare, and it's all through the billing data. So patient safety is particularly difficult to track through billing data because typically a hospital does not send a bill saying, a little sticker on the bill, oops, the reason that's so high is we made a big mistake. It's not going to say, oh, there was a surgical site infection, that's why the patient was there for a month in the hospital or something, or discharged to rehab when they should have just been out of the hospital in 2 days. It's very hard to find a lot of these problems and errors. Very difficult to find if there was a medication error that might have caused, you know, an extra day in the hospital, caused by some kind of mistake that was not tracked in the billing data. The reason we have better data now is because there have been many efforts to be better about it. There's now data coming out of CMS, which is the agency that runs Medicare, uh-huh. that requires hospitals to report their rates of different kinds of errors and infections. And that's where we get data. We also have to ask hospitals, because there's lots of things we don't know. They know. So LeapFrog actually asks them to give us some data as well to help us to better understand infection rates and things like that. Hospitals giving us that data on their own is really what is ultimately going to tell us where the safety problems are.
Well, Leah, I think LeapFrog is providing an incredibly valuable service. I think it's really important to note that these aren't arbitrary criteria. I think you've made that point really clearly, and I think people can therefore take some real confidence in it. So I have a bit of a two-part question. One, you mentioned a couple of the measures, and I wonder if you might just mention a couple more. You talked about electronic prescribing, just to give our listeners a more robust understanding. And then I have a part two to that. In the primary care domain, where we spend much of our time and focus, we are always factoring in the impact of the social determinants of health, of poverty and literacy levels, education levels, housing instability. Is there any factoring in of the social determinants when you are looking at this issue of preventable deaths in the hospital setting?
For sure, socioeconomic factors have a major impact on health systems and their ability to deliver top quality care, because people's lives can be more complicated depending on where they live and depending on their poverty and other kinds of barriers to living a full and healthy life. And so there's clearly a need to recognize the differences in socioeconomic factors that can affect the performance of a health system. However, that should not change how we calculate performance. Mm-hmm. If a hospital is serving, we call it a safety net hospital, a community that is, let's say, largely on Medicaid, if that hospital has a high death rate, we should still say, you have a high death rate. Mm-hmm. We should also recognize and say there are factors that contribute to that. So there's ways that we can talk about the factors without having to say, well, we're going to cut down on your death rate. We're going to report you as a lower death rate because your population is in poverty. That is not okay. Mm-hmm. So we have to be very, very careful, I think, as we look at quality measurement nationally, that we don't erase people's lives and say, well, we expect that because they're poor. We want to shine a light on that without saying that, therefore, your providers are expected to do less for you. We are looking only in our grades, A, B, C, D, and F, only at errors and accidents, infections, and injuries. We're only looking at those factors. And most of those, if not all of them, I think, are not affected by demographic factors per se. So let me give you an example of that. One of the measures we look at is objects left in after surgery, so sponges left in accidentally. It doesn't matter if the patient is rich or poor. A sponge should never be left in, ever. So we're looking at things that hospitals can control. Mm-hmm. Regardless of their patient population, they can make sure that they order medications correctly and make sure they get it to the right patient at the right time. Those are factors mm-hmm. that we look at. We also look at what happens at the bedside. If they have the right systems in place for making sure that the right med gets mm-hmm. to the right patient, which is also a problem. Yes. We look at things like coverage in the ICU, making sure that there's a certified intensivist physician, specially certified for ICU medicine. That can save lives by enormous factors. So those kinds of things are really not affected by the kind of population you're serving. It's affected by the hospitals putting a high priority on safety.
We're speaking today with Leah Binder, president and CEO of LeapFrog Group, an independent nonprofit organization dedicated to improving safety and quality in American hospital care. Ms. Binder launched the Hospital Safety Grade, which just released its latest report on how hospitals scored across the country. You know, Leah, I was looking at the report, and I'm going to move out of Connecticut. We're ranked 40th, which is kind of scary. And yeah. I might well move to Washington State, which came out on top. Tell us how the state rankings are compiled, and are there other factors that go into that?
Well, we do state rankings based on the percentage of hospitals in a state that earned an A from us. So I would say Connecticut has been a concern. They have not been ranked high ever on our list of states, and they should be. That is a state with some very significant hospitals, health resources. They are often pioneers and innovators So they need to put more of an emphasis on patient safety. I'm very happy that you have great innovations, but when I walk in your hospital, right, or my loved one does, don't give me an infection. Thanks. So I'm very disappointed in Connecticut in general, although they have some A hospitals. New York, I'm just frustrated with New York because that's a state and a city, particularly New York City, where so much of the next generation of healthcare providers are being trained. And yet their performance on safety is terrible. And we just don't see very many A hospitals in New York at all. Whereas New Jersey, that's one of the top states in the country. They've consistently had very high percentage of A's. Mm-hmm. They've shown improvement over time. And they're, I think they're number six as a state. They've been mostly in the top 10. So you can look in New England for Maine. Maine has been in the top 10 or top 5, really, since we started grading hospitals. So there's real variation in states. And a lot of it has to do with hospital associations. I've seen some great leadership from hospital associations in different states that have really put an emphasis on safety and really brought together leaders from different hospitals, including CEOs, to try to share best practices and share some of their data with each other so that they can understand how they're benchmarking in their state. So I think there needs to be more leadership on that issue in certain states, and there's certainly very positive and promising results in states where they do have strong leadership from the hospitals.
Well, Leah, I wonder if I could get you to comment on another area that is of real concern to us, and that's what we're seeing with maternal death rates. This is something that astonishes me, that our maternal death rate is higher than the other industrialized countries. We see disparities by access to prenatal care. We see disparities on purely racial and ethnic grounds. But also, I know that the LeapFrog group has been engaged for a number of years in a particular campaign to influence hospitals and expectant mothers and clinicians to reduce the number of planned early C-sections on the basis that that leads to higher costs and poorer outcomes. Could you talk about the larger issue of what LeapFrog is looking at or thinking about relative to maternal death and also the impact of your specific campaign and how that perhaps has influenced outcomes?
The Joint Commission, which is the accrediting organization that accredits the majority of hospitals in the country, I think they are about to finalize a measure that hospitals will be expected to adhere to on procedures they need to take to prevent maternal mortality. There's a certain set of steps and education for providers that's necessary in order for them to be monitoring women more closely and mm-hmm. recognizing signs of deadly problems in mothers. So we're going to be watching for that. I'm certain that the Joint Commission will not make that public by hospital, but LeapFrog can. We have our survey. We ask hospitals to voluntarily give us information we can't get, and that will certainly be something we will look at to ask hospitals to give us what they gave to Joint Commission on whether they're complying with that, because we agree it's disgraceful, actually, that our country has the highest and on a growing rate of maternal death. There's just no excuse for that. This must stop. And I know we can stop this because, as a country, we have done a great job in stopping another problem, which you alluded to earlier, which is early elective deliveries. These are deliveries, whether by C-section or vaginal birth, but deliveries that are scheduled without a medical reason prior to 39 weeks. So prior to when Mother Nature says this is when the baby's to be born, they schedule them. And ACOG, which is the organization for obstetricians and gynecologists, as well as leading authorities like March of Dimes, have said don't do these deliveries. They're not safe for babies. They're not safe for the moms. The NICUs are populated too often with babies that come from these early elective deliveries. And now there's even been research that it can have significant issues for babies developmentally over their childhood. So LeapFrog, we started reporting on these back in 2010, and we found a rate of about 17%, which was far too high. And we found some hospitals had a rate like at 40 or 50%, and another hospital would have a 2% rate. There's no reason for the difference. So once I think hospitals saw for themselves the variation and recognized too many of these were happening, they took it on, and I think we saw enormous leadership among hospitals, as well as the March of Dimes, ACOG, and a number of others. And so since 2010, that rate has gone way down. It's plummeted. Today, it's about 2.8%. So it's something that we knew we could address. Mm-hmm. We all knew it was a problem. We saw the data, and we made it transparent.
Yep.
I mean, it helps when things are out there for everyone to see, and now they're down. So we can do the same thing with maternal mortality, but we're going to all have to work together, and we're going to have to make this public.
You know, Leah, I want to pick up on your phrase there of transparency. You know, when I'm in New York City and I'm going to a restaurant, I look at the sign outside. It's either an A, B, or a C.
Right.
I don't go into a B or a C. And why aren't we after our lawmakers to say every hospital should post big letter outside that this is an A, B, or C? So what can we do to get this grading system adopted, but also legislatively? If it's good for us in terms of eating, my God, it's got to be much more important if we're going into a hospital to know that we've got a C rating and we have no idea.
It's interesting because we actually designed our letter grade system, our hospital safety grade, exactly around the New York City restaurant ratings. And it was also done in L.A., and in L.A. they actually had a couple studies that showed that once they implemented the letter grades for restaurants, they saw a reduction in emergency visits for foodborne illness. So, I mean, there really is a direct correlation. So we're a voluntary system. We're not trying to legislate anything, but certainly what's important to us with our letter grade is for the public to use it. And by the way, purchasers, meaning employers and health plans, anyone who's paying for large amounts of health care, and your government may be paying for large amounts of health care. The employees of a state or the employees of a city are run by a government, so they should be demanding A's. And people who go to a hospital, if they say, wait, you don't have an A? And why don't you have an A? If they even just ask the question, it can make a big difference. So, but hopefully they do more than ask the question. They also say, well, doctor, I know you want to schedule me in that hospital, but I'm not comfortable because they got a D and I'm just not comfortable there. So is there somewhere else? You know, we have to push back because this is something where our lives are threatened. Hospitals need to hear from the public. They need to be reminded who comes first. And the best way to remind them is the old-fashioned marketplace, the same marketplace that tells restaurants, if you get less than an A, I'm not going there.
Mm-hmm.
And that works. So what legislators can do, they can, first of all, the way that states, cities, municipalities, all kinds of government entities purchase health care, they should be paying attention to this. They should be demanding this in their contracting and in all of the benefits designs that they do. That should be a critical element. No hospital that gets a D should be on some center of excellence list, or should be you should have to, you know, pay more if you go to a hospital that consistently fails to deliver the kind of safety that we all deserve. So there's ways that I think we can all work on this, and hopefully we're beginning to see momentum. In fact, we are beginning to see momentum in people doing exactly that, really using this grade to send a message about the importance of safety.
We've been speaking today with Leah Binder, President and CEO of the Leapfrog Group, an independent nonprofit organization that's dedicated to improving safety and quality in American hospital care. You can learn more about their work and access their latest report by going to leapfroggroup.org or follow them on Twitter at Leapfrog Group. Leah, we want to thank you for your ongoing commitment to exposing causes of harm in healthcare and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today and bringing this really important information to the American public. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, and thank you so much for raising awareness about so many issues, including this one.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
A Twitter spat between President Donald Trump, his son Eric, and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio touched on the public health issue of crime. The Trumps claimed crime has risen in the city under de Blasio's leadership. But that's wrong, according to crime data kept by the New York Police Department. Major felony offenses have dropped every year de Blasio has served as the city's mayor, according to NYPD data. Other felonies are down, misdemeanors are down, arrests are down. According to FBI crime data, New York City had a lower violent crime rate than all but two other cities with a population over 1 million in 2017. Nonetheless, in a Twitter spat with de Blasio on May 14th, Eric Trump claimed that under de Blasio's leadership, quote, crime is up in New York City. 2 days later, de Blasio, a Democrat, announced his bid for the presidency. That prompted President Trump to sarcastically tweet that, quote, if you like high taxes and crime, he's your man. As a mayoral candidate in 2013, de Blasio vowed to end the controversial stop and frisk policy, a get tough on crime tactic of stopping people for suspicious activity that was begun under former Mayor Rudy Giuliani and expanded under former Mayor Michael Bloomberg. As it faced court challenges, the policy was well on its way out by the time de Blasio took office in early 2014, but it was greatly reduced during his tenure. Although many critics warned it would spur a return to higher crime rates, that didn't happen. Patrick Sharkey, a sociology professor at New York University, told us, quote, crime is definitely not up under de Blasio. The murder rate, Sharkey told us, has stayed consistent under de Blasio, falling in 2017 and 2018. Last year was the lowest murder rate on record for the city, he said. In 2017, the latest full year available for city-specific data from the FBI's Uniform Crime Report, New York City's violent crime rate was the lowest since at least 1985, the last year available through the FBI's online search tool. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. According to the World Health Organization, some 35 million people suffer from some form of dementia, and 65 million people are expected to develop dementia by the year 2030, with relatively few treatments available and still no cure on the horizon. Often when cases become more advanced, patients are unable to live on their own. They may be in nursing homes, may be sedated. But studies show those dementia patients who remain more active, who stay outside the clinical setting, are more likely to have a much better quality of life. And that's the basis for a first-of-its-kind dementia village in the Netherlands, Hogeve, an enclosed village built to look and feel exactly like a normal village, but designed to house patients with advanced dementia.
I think one of the things that are very important to people with dementia is that they don't understand what's happening around them. They don't understand the world anymore. We try to help people understand what's happening and let them feel that it's okay.
Co-founder Yvonne van Amerongen says these patients have lost their ability to process new surroundings, and the enclosed village provides a safe and pleasant environment for them to live where they can walk, socialize, remain engaged. The village was built on 4 acres with 23 connected housing units where patients are grouped based on their earlier personal lifestyles, whether it was based on interest in the arts or music, academics, gardening, and all living areas are manned 24/7 with trained clinicians who help to maintain a sense of normalcy as well as safety. And the director says it ensures that they maintain social connections.
Those people you live with should be people that could be your friends, people you would pick to live with. Those people probably have the same ideas on life, the same values, and we call that lifestyles.
Residents are free to walk throughout the compound. There are stores to shop in, restaurants to dine in, and a theater for performances and daily presentations. And the director says, relatively no need for excess medications or restraints that are so commonly used in dementia wards in so many nursing homes around the globe. The village is neat and orderly, easily navigable and pleasant. In a way, some have compared it to the movie The Truman Show. But the village co-founder says it's necessary to maintain a predictable routine. a planned enclosed residential community designed to maximize quality of life for dementia patients, allowing a communal living experience that feels as close to normal as possible, creating a life with dignity for patients who might ordinarily be institutionalized, sedated, or restrained. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.